Okay, our agenda is here. Today on the agenda, we have any remaining JSON-LD spec bugs that we want to deal with, maybe things that came up in the test suite. I know Marcus and Dave Longley have been having a conversation about one particular part of the algorithms in the spec. Then we should talk a bit more at test suite design. If Greg, you can take us kind of through your thoughts, and maybe we could give some input on what we want the test suite to do by the time we're at a last call. And then we should also spend a bit of time on implementation report planning. Basically, how are we going to prove that these implementations pass the test suite and are conforming with the spec? Typically, we're required to put together an implementation report before the spec can proceed along the standards track at W3C. Are there any updates or changes to the agenda? Like I'm scribing today.
I don't know. Do we want to discuss the comment we got from, I can't remember his name, Boris something regarding the API? Yeah, exactly.
Oh, jeez. Yep. Yeah.
We can do that at the end if we still have time.
Yeah, and I unfortunately did not. I haven't seen that yet, so we'll. If someone can grab a link to that when we get to the agenda item, that would be good.
Sure.
In fact, we might want to deal with that first. We want to stay on top of these last call comments, and figure out if we can get an official response back to the submitter, just because kind of queuing them up to the end of last call, we might have to deal with too many of them. It'll slow us down, so we should deal with them as they come in.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that... let's see. Quick note. If it is a last call comment, we should not be using the issue tracker, the JSON-LD org issue tracker. We shouldn't be using the GitHub issue tracker. There are legal issues associated with tracking last call comments. We have to prove that we have dealt with the issue. And everything, it's best if we have a good recording of the conversation that happened with the submitter, and the W3C issue tracker does that automatically. If we don't do that, there's a possibility that we might miss an email or comment on the mailing list about it. So, Marcus, I think we're going to have to track all of these in the RDF working groups issue tracker. Let's discuss that really quickly. So this is issues. Let's see, issue tracking. Let's see, last call. So we're going to want to track all issues using the W3C RDF worker issue tracker. We should have a project called JSON-LD last call one.
That issue track also track emails on the RDF comment list?
That is a good question.
If the issue number is in the subject, I believe it will add it.
Yeah, hopefully. So If it doesn't, it should be configured to do it. Let's see if I click. All right. So let's deal with Boris's comment first. Does that make sense to everybody? All last call issues should be being tracked by the RDF working group issue tracker at this point. So Marcus, we might want to move that issue over and then close it in the JSON-LD issue tracker.
Yeah, as you want. I mean, the nice thing about having one in GitHub as well is that you can reference commits to it, which you can't do with the W3C one. But
that's true. We usually copy and paste the entire URL to GitHub when we do that. If the GitHub issue tracker had some kind of hook that you could tell it to like scan a mailing list and pick up the issue number and put it in as a comment, that would be ideal. But we haven't seen something that does that. The other thing is to have some kind of program running in the background that automatically adds comments in when somebody writes an email to the mailing list with that issue number in there.
You could probably do it with a post with some form of a API hook, but
yep. There's
a little programming involved. So someday someone will do that.
Yeah, I mean the best thing would be to have the issue being tracked in the GitHub's issue tracker because it's a better issue. It's a better tracker as far as I'm concerned.
So from now on, all last call issues are exclusively tracked in the W3C issue tracker?
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
And there's the product that could be used.
Thank you, Greg. That's great. Yep, and we should tag every single one of them with that product. It just makes creating the final report for last call much easier, and then documenting it in CR and PR makes it much easier to just refer to one product in the issue tracker and see that all of them have been dealt with, and you can go to each one of the bugs and see the email conversation and the official response there as well. I think what we're probably going to want to do is talk to the RDF working group and ask them and see if they'd be okay with us officially handling last call issues in this group and doing the official responses from this group. So over the next couple of weeks, we can deal with official responses to these last call issues. So we should talk about that tomorrow on the RDF working group call. Anything else on how we're tracking or dealing with these issues? Okay, let's go ahead and open an issue on the issue tracker.
I'm doing that right now.
Okay, great.
Just copy and pasting stuff from
PC. Okay. Make sure to put the person's name in the title of the issue. So this would be Last Call Review Comments by Boris Zabarsky. Would be the name of the issue.
Really?
Well, you don't have to put last call, but you should put the name of the person in the title of the issue.
Yeah.
And then if he sends in more issue comments, we'll put, second set of comments from Boris Zabarsky and so on. You can put order of parameters - Boris Zabarsky. That would be a fine way of doing it.
Yeah, that's what that is. Here's the link.
Great. Thank you, Marcus.
It doesn't show up in the open issues list.
It's just raised right now. It's not open, so we need to change
the
status
fine.
To open.
Yeah.
Let's see. topic. Marcus, would you have you've read the issue and have a good understanding of it? Would you mind taking us through it if that's the case?
Yeah, sure. So the issue is rather simple. It's I would say stylistic issue. In Node, typically the callback parameter comes last in a method signature, and what Boris says is that on the web, so the web platform, typically the options parameter comes last. So there is kind of a conflict between these two styles, and Boris argues that since we are defining a web API which is intended to be implemented natively in a browser, the options parameter should come last according to the normal conventions used in that platform. The other thing was that a couple of people are trying to push futures for such things. That was part of the discussion I had with some people regarding that web idle bug we filed, and there were, I think, two or three people who said, well, you should really do it with futures instead. Just looking for the link. The link to the web idle stuff.
Yeah. Do you have an example of where the options are set last?
Well, I didn't ask, but that's what I already showed last week. For example, the WebRTC spec has it last, or what's the other one? Geolocation, I think. Yeah, those are the two that I can remember. But I didn't ask him for more examples.
I don't know. I don't quite agree with him that that's the standard way of doing stuff in a web API. But that, you know, I think what we're going to have to do is Dave Longley's pointing out a link here.
I'm just pointing out a link to continuation passing style, just in general in most languages and as a general concept. It's understood that functions take an extra argument. It's generally the last parameter when you're using continuation passing style, which is essentially just saying your function takes another function, and that's how you're going to you'll pass control onto that function and that from there. And I don't know which web APIs he's talking about that actually do what he's saying. I think you were saying you might have asked for examples, but he didn't have any, I'm not sure. I'm unaware of APIs that have the options parameter after the callback, and after doing a little bit of research, I couldn't find too many. I couldn't find anything that actually did that. But you know, that could just be because very few people have options that go along with callbacks in these functions. However, it is very consistent that the callback is last, and a lot of people have written libraries to parse arguments that have optional parameters in them, where they're expecting the callback to always be the last parameter. In fact, they just reorganize the arguments entirely with their own custom functions, where they pop off the last argument and assume it's the callback.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to discuss such a thing because it's really just a stylistic issue and not a bug or anything. So it's kind of also a bit personal preference, I would say. But
doesn't it kind of screw stuff up in async if you don't have the callback as the last parameter?
Well,
the async library in Node and even on, you know, you can use async in the web browser and on Node.
Well, you'll have to. You might have to write custom functions for everything that you're doing. Certainly people would not be expecting it to happen. I don't think. I think it would break what a lot of JavaScript developers are expecting when they're using an asynchronous continuation style passing API. I think it would be unusual for them to pass the options last.
Yeah. This is Paul. I'm just looking through, just doing some random Google searches on it, stuff on Stack Overflow, even with jQuery and other popular things. And I say like a function options comma callback in the parameter list. So I'm not a JavaScript guy personally, but everything I've seen, it looks like the callback's last.
Okay. How about we do some pretty thorough research on this, in that we find 20 or 30 libraries, fairly popular libraries that are used in browsers and in Node.js. I mean, maybe that's, you know, we find as many examples as we can.
I think we only need to find them on the web, because it's well established that Node.js always has the callback last. I don't think anyone's going to debate that. So I think what we need to do is find web APIs and see how people use those, or, you know, find some related data to that.
Yeah, yep. I mean, the point he's raising is that's the style which is used in Node, but it's not the style that's used in the web platform, whatever that is.
Yeah, but I just don't even know if that's true. We're going to need to collect some data on that.
Yeah, sure. But, yeah, just wanted to say that digging up Node libraries won't help to argument against it.
Yeah, I agree with that, except in that people who write Node also write client-side stuff, and they like to share their code. And if there's going to, all of a sudden, if there's this break from a very common way of designing your APIs on the client versus on the server, that's pretty annoying.
Yeah. The other thing we might want to do is, there was some discussion at, it's called Script Court. It's a mailing list which I discovered when I filed that Web Idol stuff, and there people are discussing whether the group who is standardizing JavaScript and W3C should cooperate a bit better, and people volunteer to review APIs that are produced at W3C, so maybe we should ask them to review our APIs.
Yes, we should definitely do that.
Get some more opinions about it. I can send an email to that list if you want.
Yes, please do that, Marcus. It would be great to have their input.
Sure.
What was the name of the group again?
It's Public Script Cohort, like coordination, I think.
Public CRYPT Cohort?
Script, like JavaScript Cohort.
Oh, I got you. Oh, I got you, okay. And that's at w3.org?
Yeah, here it is. Just found it.
I suspect that most of the other comments about are coming from like the web apps group, and they have a list of APIs that are all HTML related. So here's sort of a list of the various different specs having APIs, and then presumably in there we'll find examples that have sort of the order inverted.
It's kind of unfortunate if we actually find out that the vast majority of APIs that people have written, that just users have done, put the callback last, but everything that's WebIDL doesn't do that, because that might just be a result of a mistake that WebIDL has made.
My guess is the rationale is that options are themselves optional, and therefore having to have them before the callback implies needing a having to put some specific null argument before your callback. The convention in Ruby is that the last arguments are options, but if you have a callback, it does come after that, and typically you don't do it explicitly. It's done using a block, but that's if you do it otherwise, it goes at the end. But Ruby can distinguish between when you're using inline options and a callback and do the right thing.
Yeah, my guess would be that WebIDL does what it does so that it can more easily support other languages like C++ and C.
Mm-hmm.
Or just C++. I don't know. I can't even remember if C has optional, has default parameters.
No. It has var args, right?
Right. You're right.
I don't feel like we want to get into a fight with the web apps guys. That hasn't been very profitable in the past.
No. Well, specifically the WebWG, the web apps guys tend to be a little more...
there is a big overlap.
Compromise. There is a big overlap. I think the general feeling here is that I feel pretty strongly about the callback as the last parameter, but we should certainly, and I guess Dave Longley, you think the callback should be the last parameter. Greg,
yeah,
I don't know if you.
I was just going to say, I actually feel like if we're going to end up not putting it as the last parameter, we almost should just go with futures, just because I think we need to either go with some new way that people may or may not be using, so it's at least different, versus doing something that I think is unconventional. I would prefer to do the callback last and just do it the simple way. But if we're going to put it out of order, I think I would almost rather just deal with the different API.
Is there a link to futures spec? Is there a spec for that?
Give you one in a minute.
So one of the problems is this is the next version of it's ECMA 5, right? So you're required to have ECMA 5 to support futures, or is that not true?
It's not ECMA 5. It's the next DOM specification.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, we can't have that in the spec. We can't. I guess.
Here's the link.
Yeah, Dave. We can't do the futures
right.
thing because we'd be referencing a spec that's not.
Yeah.
A rack.
That's in the future.
Exactly. Use the future to work on it in the future. I have a hard stop at the top of the hour. I forgot to mention that at the beginning of the call. So someone needs to go off and find examples of this. Any volunteers?
Well, I just can say that I've looked at quite a number of web APIs and I haven't found any example of what we are doing, just the ones putting the options last. If there was an option.
We've already got a link in here for adding jQuery plugins that puts the callback last. So, I mean, Paul found that right away.
Yeah, so
yeah, but that's not the...
At the same time, though, I was talking with our JavaScript guy, and he's like, oh, yeah, the callbacks, the options are always afterwards. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think it's... There still needs to be that research done.
Well, we do need to distinguish between JavaScript and IDLE.
Yes.
So, I think finding JavaScript examples won't be difficult because it's quite common in there. But
right.
For Web IDLE, it's somewhat different. So.
I would expect to always find it for Web IDLE that the callback would not be last if there were options because that's what the spec is called for.
Yeah.
We would have to find a group that decided to essentially do what we did to go around the problem And I don't know if that's likely to happen. So we need to be clear about what we're looking for. My expectation would be that most JavaScript libraries would put the callback last, and almost every, if not all, WebIDL APIs do the opposite, because that's what the spec is called for, but I think that's a mistake. And that's really what this is about, is whether or not it's a mistake.
But the question is, to what do we want to be consistent? To the other native APIs or to JavaScript libraries? And what Boris argues, we should be consistent with other web APIs and not JavaScript libraries.
Well, what ends up happening there is anyone that the native version might end up using a different order of parameters for their JavaScript versus the native API.
Yeah, I mean, so the thing is, like, if we went out and asked the Node.js community, or if we did it the other way, we would expect comments from the Node.js community saying, look, you know, we Node.js scripts are used both in Node.js and the browser, and there it's very clear that its callback should be last.
You know, this actually sounds like a perfect issue for the tag to respond to. Because it's
I really don't think the tag has any. Actually, you know what? Sorry, they do have in a couple of the guys from WG now, right?
They do. Almost half their makeup is this. But this is an example where we're sort of in some conflict and we need some architectural resolution.
I might go and ask on the WG to see what kind of feedback they have. I mean, they're usually very helpful when it comes to stuff like this. I don't know if this goes as far as technical architecture for the web, though, Greg. But I guess it doesn't hurt to ask.
Do you know who's in the tag right now? Isn't Anne van Kelsteren in the tag?
Anne is there, and but also so is Yehuda Katz, who has substantial jQuery. Robin is no longer on there, but I think his feedback would carry some weight. Melvin Carvalho's on tag.
Melvin's on the tag. I didn't know that.
Yeah. He's part of the gang of four that just came in.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, Greg, would you mind writing an email to the tag?
I don't think I have a good enough feeling for the topic to be able to coherently express it. But I could take a stab, but I don't have enough of the background. I know, Marcus, you've been involved with that. If you want to, perhaps, you want to put something together on that?
Why don't I ping the WebWG first, and if they don't have a clear answer, I'll ask the tag.
Okay.
We probably need to keep this moving along if you have that hard stop in 24 minutes.
Yeah, you're right. Okay, anything else on this issue before we move on?
I'm sorry, do you hear me?
Yes, hi Nicholas, how are you?
Okay. Hello, what was the topic?
The topic was where does the callback parameter go? Does it go as the last argument, or does an options go as the last argument? We had this discussion before, but we have a last call comment from Boris Zabarsky that says that we should be putting options last.
Right.
Yeah.
So we just need to ask.
Yeah.
So I think what we're doing is we're getting a whole bunch of, we're trying to get a bunch of examples and document it clearly, and hopefully something will come out of the documentation. And if that doesn't happen, we're asking the WG, and if they don't have a strong opinion, we're asking the TAG.
Right. I'm just thinking about the other question about the futures and the... I mean, I can see that we don't have the time to do anything with that, but I wonder if that could influence this position in some way. Like, futures are returned, and you send in a callback. Would that sort of influence the decision?
Well, we decided that we couldn't use futures because it's in a spec that is in the future, is essentially
yeah.
the problem.
Yeah.
But I think what Nicholas is saying, given the direction that futures are going, what is the last argument expected to be? Some sort of object? And in that case, would having, you know, if returning a callback causes some kind of problem, or if the thing that's returned is a callback, you know, how could that influence it? Decision.
Yeah, like if an implementation would deviate from the API in the slightest future, the last option would be the parameter option object and no callback. So I don't know if that speaks for putting the callback in the last position as we do now. Somehow feels like it does,
because we previously discussed that if the callback was omitted, you should have the results returned synchronously.
But I don't really have a good intuition on where the various APIs in Node, web APIs stand on the manifest. Move from callbacks to futures is like.
Yeah, let's do some research and see if something clear emerges. Because if we can find like, go ahead.
I was going to say we do have the option of making the callback itself optional and returning a synchronous result, and having it so that the certain versions, you know, like the JavaScript version, would just return an error if you didn't specify a callback. But other languages that are going to do things synchronously wouldn't care if there was no callback.
Yeah.
And then we could avoid the issue by just making the callback optional as well.
That's
yeah.
still the same issue, though.
Yeah. It's, one other, I don't know if it's even feasible, because I can't beforehand judge the quality of that design, but if we instead would return some sort of proto-future where we do not say that it's the DOM, but it's an object which has a when method which should be called with the callback, then we sort of invent futures in the API in a kind of minimal fashion.
Yeah. Okay, let's go out and ping some of these other groups and see what they say and kind of regroup on this next week. Just so we have a little more data to go on to make a decision on this one. Anything else on this issue before we move on? If there are no objections, I'm going to skip the JSON-LD spec bugs discussion, just because I think we should get started on our test suite design, or at least discuss it before we start talking about issues. Any objections?
Maybe. I feel like there's a bug that Marcus and I are not going to be able to resolve just emailing ourselves back and forth that we have to talk about on the call.
Okay. Would it be fairly quick to resolve that, or is it fairly involved?
It's unknown. It just depends on what people's opinions are.
Let's time block it at 10 minutes.
Okay.
And then we'll try to get a good handle on it. Do you have a link to the issue?
Yep. Marcus, do you happen to have a link to that quickly?
Give me a sec.
I can just start talking about it while he gets the link. Effectively, we've realized that there's a situation where if you have a context and you want to define a term to itself, we're trying to figure out what the behavior should be. So if you take, good, we actually have the link here. Let's see, if we look at the link. So in this example, we have RDFS subclass of in the context. And it's using its, as its ID, it's using itself. And I think in this case, Marcus and I both agreed that this should be a legal thing to do, because you can, in my opinion, the way that you would resolve this is you would see that RDFS was a prefix that was already defined. And so since it's already defined, you can figure out what the ID is supposed to be. You can expand the ID without running into a cyclical problem. Marcus, do you have the other link? Yeah, good.
That's the second one, I think.
Yeah, so in the second link, we have a different situation where we have a context that has that's an array, so there are actually two contexts here. And in the first one, we define some terms, and in the second one, if you see on line 11, we have term defined to itself. And my opinion of this is that when you're defining a new term, whenever a term appears on the left-hand side, it immediately removes any other previous definition of the term. So if you did term colon term on the right-hand side here, it would effectively be a cyclical definition, and you couldn't resolve what term means. And I think that that's important because I believe that there should be another link for this case that better highlights. Let me put the link
which
in here.
Which one?
If you look at the link that I just put in IRC, you'll look at the second context and you'll see that the second context defines at vocab. And in this case, I think defining term to itself is a perfectly legal thing to do, because you know that you can replace the right-hand side with the concatenated vocab. And the end result will be that you're using the vocab in expanded form. Effectively, what I'm saying is if you reuse anything on the left-hand side in your definition on the right-hand side, it must be defined in some other way, either by as a prefix or as at vocab. And Marcus's opinion is that you should use anything that's already existing in the context instead. So Marcus's opinion of this would be that the output would not use vocab, but instead would say would use the term on line 5, which is v colon something else. And my opinion is that whenever you start defining a term, whenever a term appears on the left-hand side, that immediately removes any previous definition, so that there's no reuse of an old definition, there's no partial definition reuse, there's nothing of that sort. In my opinion, it's simple and consistent to just say, as soon as you start defining a new term, remove the old term as if it didn't exist. And Marcus's opinion is, if you can reuse it, reuse it. And that change that results in two different outputs. And so we need to get the group's feedback to decide what the output of this last test should be, because it effectively it'll decide what the other output should be for the other link.
What does the spec say right now?
I think it's ambiguous.
I think
the only
already there.
We have checks for circular dependencies, right?
In one case.
Yes, we do. But the question is this a circular dependency? I think if at vocab was not here, I think I would consider it a circular dependency, because you're defining it to yourself and you don't exist yet. But Marcus's argument is that you existed previously, so don't remove the old definition when you're defining the new one.
So maybe if you look at this comment here, it gets clearer, because here, if you look at other term, which also reuses term, I think it would be at least I would say that it expands to V colon something else and not to that another vocab using at vocab. And
I agree there.
And if that's the case here, it would introduce an asymmetry if we would do something else if while the term redefines itself. And that's what strikes me a bit. I mean, it's not really consistent to do that, in my opinion, but...
I don't consider it a symmetry, though. And the reason is because you're defining a new term called other term. You're not overriding the existing term called term. So it doesn't feel strange to me at all.
Yeah, you define a new term using an existing term, and if the new term already exists, you just override it. But that doesn't mean that you delete the term before you override it. And that's the question. Do we want to delete it before we override it?
I think that it is easiest and most consistent to remove the term completely before trying to define anything new using it. Otherwise, I don't know what kind of partial definition stuff we might get into, and it also feels like it's more difficult to try and think about that.
No, there's nothing partial remaining. You just override the whole definition as one as soon as you have the new
I mean, as you're defining the term, if you're reusing something that existed in the previous context with the same name, what parts of the old definition do you reuse?
You reuse nothing except you reference it explicitly. And that's what happened here on the right-hand side. You reference it explicitly. There is nothing reused automatically here.
So just in general, I think that any kind of partial reuse, even while you're expanding the term, even if you completely replace the definition, is concerning to me. So the idea that we you're redefining something, yet you're, let's say you have a term called A, and you are redefining A, but you use what A is already defined as.
No, you.
While you're redefining it.
You don't use what A is already defined to. You expand A as you would do always. You would also do that if it's the value of at type somewhere.
Yeah, but the way that you expand A is by reusing the old definition. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to expand A.
Right.
Yeah, but that's what currently in scope.
I think it's, well, let's be clear. One, this is a corner case. Like, we're talking about a corner case. So most people are never going to see this. For the people that end up seeing this corner case, it seems, at least to me, when I look at both options, it seems to me that the simple rule of when a term is defined, the second you start defining that term, or when a term is redefined, the second you start defining that term, you wipe out the entry in the current active context. I think that is the simplest thing to do, because if we don't do that, then all of a sudden things start resolving to things that are set in the active context, in that, at least when you're defining the context, that seems really confusing to me.
I put another comment in here in IRC. Are alters going to be confused if they do term equals term? Is it going to keep the other properties of the term definition? I mean, clearly... I would expect that you shouldn't do that, but is it going to further confuse people because it feels like it's a partial redefinition?
No, it's not a partial redefinition. It's a
I realize that you know that, but why would you do term colon term unless you were using at vocab? And if you were using at vocab, it seems like it gives you the wrong result.
Well, that was just a minimal example, because usually we create minimal examples in tests you could as well do term colon at ID term type at ID, and before term wasn't cursed to at ID, then it wouldn't be so, it wouldn't suggest that inheriting something.
Yeah, but doesn't that seem like you're, what you're, it seems like what you're doing at that point is trying to do a partial redefinition, or you're trying to addend your definition, you're adding on to it. If we introduce that concept, couldn't that be confusing?
Well, I mean, in that case, reusing terms in the in a context definition that have already been defined is confusing all the time. So you can't argue that it's not confusing sometimes, and sometimes it is confusing. Because just
well,
because
I think when you self-reference,
side, there's, but so why if you say that looks like term inherits from term, why does other term not inherit from term in this case?
Okay, hold on. We're 1 minute outside of our time box. Let's push this back onto the mailing list. Hopefully we can get some more examples on times where it's good to do this and times where it's bad to do this, and we'll pick it up next week. Any objections before we move on? Okay. Really quickly, let's talk about the test suite design. And I think on the next call, we'll try to put this a little further up on the agenda. Greg, are there any decisions that need to be made on the test suite design?
Well, I think we've laid it. We've sort of laid out a structure for defining the tests we have. Some things to consider: are there classes of tests that we need that we don't have, and do we need to consider how the manifest might change to be able to describe them, as well as the types of results that come out of that? I think the other thing is regard to what the sort of value range of the properties we're using are. In terms of the expect property, typically it is a URL for a file to look at, but there were some cases I looked at where it was a string value, which would be used as for sort of an exception text string. I think it's not wise to sort of have the same property used for two totally different types of data in that case. But in terms of a basic description, being able to run tests against that using the manifest definitions, I've been doing that pretty much all along, and therefore reporting against that is straightforward. But there are a number of cases where I guess either we're describing the algorithmic behavior. If there are options to the algorithms, we need a way to be able to specify them. Callbacks are, I don't know how we can actually specify that. I don't know of a way to be able to do that.
The callback would be provided by the test suite, test runner, wouldn't it?
Well, but how would I specify? So the test, if you have a test that says when called as such and such, the callback must be called, you know, say some number of times with this set of values. How would I sort of specify that, and how as a test, as an implementation, could I use the knowledge that's described in the test manifest to actually implement that test correctly?
This is basically the same problem that we had with the RDFA 1.1, like remote REST calls. How do you specify arguments to algorithms that the implementation should be accepting?
Yeah. So in that case, we provided a way. We added some properties that described the parameters that were added, and there was a way of just doing a URI encoding of those parameters, which was, I don't know if it was defined in the spec or just as part of the test suite.
Okay.
This is a little bit more difficult because we're not only describing different parameters that might be provided, but they're not necessarily scalar parameters. For instance, it might be a different context or something like that. And there's the whole behavior of the callback.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it seems like you have to have a dedicated kind of test runner to run it against your language.
I think it really, at this point, it's a matter of at what level do we describe what these things should be? Is it, for instance, we provide a JavaScript function that must be called with its parameters properly marshaled, and then that purpose of that function is to test that it's called properly, and other languages need to adapt to be able to call out to the JavaScript function? Or can it be done in a more generic fashion, but programmatically, so you don't have to actually write these things by hand, potentially for each test?
So I think that if we were just doing this in JavaScript, we would have a Mocha-powered test suite. Mocha is just a testing framework. And we would just do a whole bunch of unit tests in JavaScript, and it would just be a file that you would run after including, basically requiring your specific implementation. So you would name your implementation something like JSON-LD, and then the Mocha test script would do JSON-LD dot expand dot compact and passing a whole bunch of different options. So that would be the easiest way to test it in JavaScript. The question is, how do you adapt that to the other languages?
Well, the other thing is to just continue to test at an algorithmic basis, in which we are basically looking for, you know, data in and data out, and we don't try to test the actual API mechanism. There's certainly an argument to keep those separated, and that the details of the algorithm should be done in sort of algorithm tests, and API could almost be implemented using mock types of behavior so that we're not overlapping too much. It'd probably be worth doing a survey of the other API specs that are out there to see if they, how they have approached these problems.
I think for the API, we need to define some tests to show that an implementation is, well, it complies to the API we specified. We could either extend that idle harness there or create some JavaScript test suite which other people can reuse. And we could also, like Greg already probably has one in Ruby, I have one in PHP, so we could just upload them somewhere and people can adjust them to create those reports, for example.
I think that would be perfect for CR. So we just, let's just do that. We have a JavaScript test suite, a Ruby test suite, and a PHP test suite. The code's already written for most of that stuff, so let's just upload those to GitHub and say if you are not programming in these languages, create a test suite that matches these languages.
Yeah, I think that's easier for most developers than reading prose and figuring out what to do.
Yeah, we just do need to be sure that we have defined the things in the manifest that we need to be able to run them. And optional values are, there's just a different set for each algorithm. We need a way that describes that. And note that is different than the options for the API, because we have fewer options for the algorithms.
We've actually already taken some of the existing test suites and just adapted them to for our C# implementation.
And I think that's what we want to be able to do, specifically for people that are looking for this from RDF purposes, where they already have test runners for other RDF languages. If we can make it easy for them to adapt, the fact that we're using the same vocabulary for the manifests, and I think sort of makes that simpler.
Yep. Okay. I have to go. You guys can do we want to continue talking and talk about implementation report planning? If so, Greg or Marcus, feel free to just take over the call. But that's up to you guys.
Yeah. Is there something we still need to discuss, like options, or do we want to define them today, or?
Silence. So let's go ahead and enter the call, or let's go ahead and end the call, and let's try and come up with some other things that we need to talk about concerning the test suite and the implementation for next week. Okay, anything else?
Nope.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Have a good week. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.